did the unit, I'm just going to restate the question, how did the unit react to the first casualties being from friendly fire?
Well, I guess the probably took it a little hard to a certain extent because one of the sergeants of Rogan was a wonderful young man. He was young, I mean, and a wonderful person. And his buddy that was with him at the time, Rattler Powell, was obviously one of the southern guys, but in fact they brought him into my CP, we had set up a command post in the house there on the front, and brought him in there and brought him in there before the medics could get there, and it was too late of course. It was a little, give you a foretaste of what was going to happen, yeah.
Did it hurt morale that it was someone from...
Pardon?
Did it hurt morale that it was an American that had killed him, or...?
Well, I don't think it affected too much otherwise, because you know where we were there and what's going to happen, and that everybody isn't going to come back.
Right. And so, when was the first time that you actually met the Germans face-to-face on the battlefield?
Well, it was on the, about the 8th of May, we moved. Well, I suppose we could go back a little further, a couple of days before that. We knew what was going to happen, it was going to kick off on the 11th of May, and some of the officers and myself and a couple of others, I guess, went into town, this town that's right on the edge of the front lines, you know, and to look and see the route we were going to take going in, and what we could do and how we could get there. And while we were there, the Germans opened up a machine gun, we called it Machine Gun Alley, and dropped a couple of shells in there on us, and I jumped, there was a door right close by there, and the shell came in, I jumped, and I was going to go in this door, and inside the building, and opened the door, and there's nothing on the other side but a hole in the ground. It's just the front wall standing with the door in it. So I kind of disappointed us on that. But anyway, we found out pretty much what we wanted to find out, and we went back and to where the troops were stationed in the back, and then in the reserve. We were placed in reserve for that particular deal. And that was the closest thing to contact as we came, yeah, the first time.
First time, right. And how did you react afterwards? I mean,
I don't know. I guess, like I say, I can't recall that I was ever scared any time, even at this time. And, I might mention while we were just shortly before this, we were just on the stationary line where General Mark Clark came up to our company and come up to inspection, I guess, and look around. And I started talking to him a little bit, and he asked me where I was from, and I wasn't thinking that he probably meant what outfit or had come from regular army or what, I don't know. But anyway, I told him I was from Minnesota, and he said, oh, Minnesota, he says, anywhere close to Detroit Lakes. And I said, yeah, about 60 miles from there. Well, he says, I've been up there on a vacation, he says, here some time ago. And I had a letter from the people up there in the Chamber of Commerce that when the war was over, to come back up there and spend a week's vacation in the house. And he says, I might do that. And I noticed a few years later after the war, there was a notice in the paper where General Mark Clark had returned to Detroit Lakes.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about any other memorable experiences you had? Or
pardon?
Can you tell me about any other memorable experiences you had?
Well, I had a talk with the King of England, King George VI.
Oh, wow.
This was when during the war, and we were called out in the rear arrested area and lined up for a review. And King George VI, and of course, I think Mark Clark was along, and our own General Coulter, a few dignitaries had come through, and King George came right in front of me, and I had my combat infantry badge on, and so he kind of felt of that and asked what it represented, and so I explained to him what it was. Is combat troops and so forth and so on, and so he said okay, and he moved on, so I can say the conversation with King George VI.
Oh, wow. Oh, great.
But that's about the only dignitary, I guess, other than...
Now, I was reading through some of your stuff, you got to visit quite a few historical places when you were some downtime. What was that like?
Well, that was interesting, of course, too, yes. I guess the first place was probably in Rome, when we got into Rome. And then later on, the one of Mussolini's academies there was used as a rest center, so that people could take their passes and go there and stay for a couple of days, and went in there a few times, and we got to visit the St. Peter's Cathedral, and Victor Emmanuel Monument, I believe it is. I remember now offhand. What do you call the old ruins?
On Forum? The Colosseum?
Yeah, Colosseum.
Colosseum, yeah.
Yeah, and several other places like that in Rome. And I got to go up in the Leaning Tower of Pisa a couple of times. Oh. That was quite an experience, too. The thing, the way it leans, and there's a spiral staircase that goes up there on the inside of it, like going inside of a silo up there, and you kind of one side, you feel you're going to tip over. But it's a bell tower for the church, there's what it is. And
how did the Italians receive you Americans? Because they had been on the German side initially in the war.
They were really nice to get along with. I mean, they like to trade things too and whatnot. And the boys found the girls very accommodating for Hershey bars. But as a whole, they were very good. I know we stopped several places along the line when we were on the move, and probably stopped at a town or near a farm or something, and they were very accommodating. Let us use their facilities for the stay there. And for the most part, they were very, very well received. The only thing that I remember wasn't very nice about them is we pulled into a brick factory area on our drive, and some of us stayed in this old brick, inside the brick factory there, where they were making bricks and whatnot. And a couple of days after we'd been there, lo and behold, some of the guys got investigating around there, little bit, and they found something that looked kind of suspicious, and it had a bunch of corn shocks sticking up against the wall there someplace, and pulled them apart, and they found lots of 5-gallon GI gasoline cans full of gas stored in there. They hijacked someplace along the way. Yeah. But otherwise, I guess they were pretty accommodating. I know when we marched through Rome, the local citizens, they were amazed at how quiet we walked because we had rubber-heeled shoes on. And they used to have the Germans with their spikes. Hanging in the concrete when you walked, yeah.
Oh, wow. I was looking through your pictures, and I have a couple of questions about these. First of all, there's one picture where you have a group of people, some from South Africa, Brazil, and some Americans. And so,
yeah.
What was it like, first of all, can you tell me about that photograph? Second of all, what was it like meeting people from all around the world like that?
Well, I never had too much really close contact with them. I was taking that a rest area, I guess. But I know the Indian troops, they used the mules for transportation, everything. They didn't have any vehicles.
That's the mule skinners?
Yeah, the mule skinners.
What does a mule skinner, I mean, they're not really skinning mules, are they? That's a slang term, I'm assuming.
No, they... For us, they hauled up rations and ammunition and supplies in the mountain areas where they couldn't drive a jeep or anything. They loaded it on the back of these mules and hauled it up there to us. And they also then hauled casualties down, those that had been killed, put them on the back of these mules and hauled them down to where the medics could take care of them.
Right. Sure. And so you didn't have a lot of contacts.
No, not really. But they heard stories about these Indian troops, Gurkhas they call them, I believe. They could sneak up on the Germans at night and cut the throat and disappear, and they never know they'd been there.
Oh, wow. How often did you stay in contact with your family while you were overseas?
Oh, well, see, by that time, the family was pretty well spread out, and I tried to write, I guess, probably about once a month, and I had the use of this typewriter, so duplicate, type up duplicate letters and send each one of them, yeah. But I suppose it's about once a month, something like that. And incidentally, probably a good time to mention the fact that I had a pen pal experience when I was in the service, who I kept in contact with quite often. When I was down in Mississippi, I saw this picture of this gal on somebody's wall down there. It was a picture of a sister of this guy's girlfriend. And so I got her address and wrote to her and struck up a pen pal relationship. And we rode back and forth quite often all the time I was in the service practically.
Oh.
And when I got discharged, you had your choice where you wanted to get discharged, and I wanted to get discharged at Fort Meade, Maryland, because she lived in Baltimore.
Oh.
And I figured, well, that's the least I can do is to stop when I get out and meet her and greet her and to show her appreciated what she'd been, all the letters I'd received from her. So I got discharged at Fort Meade, Maryland. I went into Baltimore and got a room in a hotel there, and I couldn't find any phone number or anything, and to call her and stopped two or three taxi cabs and showed them the address where they wanted to go, although they didn't know where that was. So I had to sit down on the first night I was there and wrote her a letter. And she got the letter, and I got her the next morning, and she come down to the hotel, and she and actually she only worked about two blocks from where I was staying.
Oh, really?
So I spent about a week there visiting with her, dining and dancing, and visiting, and had a real nice time, everything, and was there about a week, and had to take off for home.
What was it like meeting her for the first time in person after you'd been corresponding?
Well, it was like I've known her for years. Sure. Yeah, we got along very, very nice. In fact, I had rumors, and whether it was then or after that she was engaged to some sailor. but we had a very cordial relationship, and just like I say, honestly, known each other for years. Well, we've been writing together for about 3 years.
Right. Did you keep in contact with her after the war?
I did for a short while, and to tell you right now, I couldn't tell you what her name is. I've often wondered about it.
Sure.
In fact, the girlfriends I had when I went in there, service I had too, was I thought were pretty good, steady people, but they both got married while I was gone.
Oh, no.
But that's all right. I got home, I found one better anyway.
There you go. Do you have any other combat stories you want to share?
I don't know if I want to cover, I got these awards and medals that I received.
Yeah, sure.
I have, you know, if you've got a picture there, I think with the one, or it should be a picture in there with a kind of a collage of my army stuff. But anyway, first of all, the good conduct medal, which you get in the army, you get that for being good for 3 months without getting into any trouble. Everybody gets one of them, and then if you get in trouble, they take it away from you again. And combat infantry badge, of course, if you're in a hazardous air duty area under fire, enemy fire, and combat, so you get that, and that'd be $15 a month extra pay. And then I got the Purple Heart for wounds. I got wounded on my knee.
How did you get wounded?
Pardon?
How did you get wounded?
That's kind of a long story, but I'll tell it to you because it's one that I should get included in there. So we were moving up, this was on Friday the 13th.
Oh.
In fact, it started out on Friday the 12th of October 1944. We were moving up into the attack, and our company got, it was real dark, and you had to almost hang on to the guy in front of you to find out where he was going, because you lose contact, you're lost. And that's what happened. Somebody, one of these older guys we had, lost contact, and about half the company got lost behind, and I was in that group, and another officer, and so we got the heads together, what we're going to do now, and he said, well, we don't know where we're going or where we're at, so let's pull back to the hill behind, we just left, and dig in there for the night, and in the morning we'll send out some patrols and see if we can contact the rest of the company. So we did that. We pulled back to the top of this ridge back there, and dug in, and the morning came, our own planes came in and strafed on us, and there was a tank sitting about 200 yards from where I was there, and got knocked out. But anyway, we sent the patrol out, and they found the rest of the company, so we got organized and took off of there. It was down a kind of a ravine, and there was Germans on both sides of the ravine firing at us. In fact, there was one church on the one side, the hole in the roof, and they were using that to fire the mortars out of there that fire out through the roof of this church. But anyway, we finally got up to where the rest of the company was, and they were holed up there. Part of them were in this old house area, and they were firing, and they had captured about 20 prisoners, I guess, before that. And had them inside this house, and actually was out in front of our front lines, and our own tanks were firing at us, and I stood on the corner of this stone building, looking to see if I could spot the tank so we could somehow or other get it called off, and I couldn't spot it, and from the time I stepped from that side of the corner to the other corner, just a matter of one step, direct fire tank shell landed where I'd been standing.
Oh.
And it was an armor piercing, it wasn't a explosive type one, so, but it hit my rifle, my pack was in the standing alongside the building there then, and hit that and shook the building up pretty good. But later on, there was a Germans were counterattacking us again, and they had to call in our own artillery, and our artillery, some of the shells were hitting the top of the house of the building we were in, and we got them stopped off. In fact, we captured some more prisoners there, and later on, night, I knew we were going to get relieved that night, and so we were hanging on there, and the medics had some of our wounded in there, were trying to patch them up, and in fact I was helping with what I could, holding a flashlight on one of the guys was trying to manage the guy's head up, bust it open, and I couldn't take it anymore. He had to give it to somebody else to hang on to. But they were dropping shells in close to the door and blew the door open. And so I went over and I closed the door and I put my foot against the bottom of the door and I leaned back against the stone wall so in case it got anything or was a little protection there anyway. But lo and behold, another shell came in and hit, and a hunk of shrapnel came through the door and hit me in the leg.
Oh.
And it stung pretty good, but I didn't think too much of it. So one of the guys noticed the blood running down my pants leg.
Oh.
And so, of course, the medics was right there, so they patched me up. And I knew we were going to get relieved that night. And so I didn't want to go to the hospital, and so stay with the company.
Right.
And after a while, when this other unit came up and was going to relieve us, the Germans dropped another shell, and then there was 14 casualties from that.
Right.
So I always say Friday the 13th is my lucky day.
Yeah. I guess. Did you earn any other citations or medals?
Pardon?
Did you earn any other citations or medals?
Yeah. I got the Soldier's Medal. That was up, well, here again, we were actually probably out in some of the front lines. And it was the night, it had been raining. And we came to this old dairy barn. It's a big steel dairy barn, good size one. Quite a few, a lot of the guys were inside this building, and some outside around the other buildings around there. And the mule skinners had come up and left a load of ammunition right on the edge outside the door of this building we were in, and they took off again right away. But a little bit later on, then a German shell came in and hit this ammunition dump and started a fire. And I suggested one of the platoon leaders, the officers, to send some men out there to get the damn fire out before it blew up, because there'd be a lot of GIs get hurt if it got blew up, and nobody would go. And I asked some others, nobody would go, so finally I volunteered myself, and I asked somebody to go along, so another fellow, Sergeant Kane, offered to go along with me, so we went out there, and we got the fire out, and threw the pieces out that were on fire, so the rest of it wouldn't blow up, so it would have given away our position more. I mean, if it had gotten a bigger fire guard and blew up, then they knew they hit something. So, as a result of that action, I've been recommended for the Silver Star.
Oh.
And, but the medal committee, I guess, looked at it different. As the Silver Star is where you have direct contact with the enemy and probably capture three or four, or some are killed, so many, or something like that. But they said here we weren't in actual physical contact with the enemies, so they couldn't do that, so they changed it to a soldier's medal, which is a medal that is given for anyone for heroic actions, for saving life, and things like that, and which is fine for me. The other guy thought they should have the Silver Star, so no, I said, let's take it. And so they awarded the soldier's medal to us. And the soldier's medal is the only medal other than the Medal of Honor that pays extra money for for you. And the soldier's medal, we paid $2 a month at that time, extra pay while I was in the service.
Oh, wow.
And the Medal of Honor at that time was only $10 a month.
Oh, wow.
Later on, they changed it after the war. They changed that and made the Medal of Honor to $100 a month.
Wow.
And, but the soldier's medal, they didn't figure that was necessary to increase that.
Right.
And I got the bronze medal star for duty far and above and beyond the duty. Actually, I guess if I look back, the reason I got that one was, let's see, we were pinned down going into this one town. It was kind of up on a bluff, and there was a canal in between us, and we were fighting, and we used up a lot of ammunition, and the Jeep drivers holding the ammunition trailer abandoned the Jeep out in no man's land there, and we were running down the short on ammunition, and I told them to go out and get the trailer, get the Jeep in there so they get some ammunition, and they wouldn't go because it was too dangerous, and nobody else would go, so I went out there and got the Jeep and drove it back in the area, and so they could take it and go get some more ammunition. And that's, I guess, the reason they got that one.
Oh, wow.
And, I guess, and then they have the Victory Medal, of course, which they all got for the victory of the war.
Right.
So I guess that's what covers my decorations, although I think I sent you a copy of the letter I got, too, from the, company commander at home.
Yeah, from Captain Bannister.
Hello.
Yes, from Captain Bannister.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
No, No, a little better now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yes, I got. Yeah, you gave me a copy of the letter from Captain Bannister.
Well, I, like I say, of all the letters I got, I probably like that letter of commendation from him more than any of the medals, because that wasn't just for one little thing. That was for my entire career.
Right.
And I did see the commander a couple times after that at the Army Buddy reunions. But he passed away here about, I suppose maybe 10 years ago now. From what, I don't know, because family never notified me to tell me about it. I found out through the grapevine how it happened.
Right. Now, how did you guys, it says in the introduction to this letter that you guys became close friends. I mean, was it awkward him being an officer and you being an enlisted man, or?
Well, the company commander is in charge of the company, about 200 people, and his is more or less with training and then tactics on the battlefield. And my job being working out of the command posts with the first sergeant started with and then later by myself, was in charge of the more or less the physical being of the men. And when in camp, when they're in the barracks area, it was my job to say who was going to be on guard duty that day, who was going to be on the kitchen police that day, and the work details and all that sort of thing. And generally, their physical being was my job. So between the two of us, I mean, we were in charge. And very, very good friends, yeah.
And can you describe some stories regarding Captain Bannister and yourself? You know, like, what did you guys do? What kind of, friendship did you guys have?
Well, there wasn't very a lot of socializing type of thing. Between us, it was mostly business. On the battlefield, he was in charge of all the orders, and it was my job to keep track of the physical being of the men, if they were wounded or if they were sick or if they were killed or captured or whatever. It was my job to look after that, and he, in turn, kind of looked after me a little bit, so that I was in such a position to do that. And I know one time we were in the action on the front line there, and he and some of the other officers were out about a mile or so ahead of us, observing another outfit, and I asked him if I should move the command post out there where he was at, and he said no. He said you stay where you're at there. He says, and just a short while later, a shell came in out there and killed a couple of officers and wounded a couple other. And so, like I say, he sort of looked after me too.
right. One thing I noticed from the documents or the story that you typed up, the history of your unit, is that you were responsible for, or you observed the court-martial of 17 men. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. I guess I've made a notation of that here someplace, too, so... well, you see, when you're in battle, and... you can't report somebody as being EWOL, or you can't wave without leave, or you can't say that they were killed in action, or captured, or anything like this. Actually, what we have to do is report them as missing in action. And these particular people that we're talking about here now were people on different occasions, not all at the same time. on different occasions were set up mostly on outposts for when we're moving up. We moved a lot of that night, and they would be the captain or an officer would take them out and post them different places, so that when the company came at night, they'd know where to go, and they'd turn them on to go. Well, several of these guys were on the outposts and disappeared, and when we got there, there was nobody there. And actually, it put the whole company in jeopardy.
Right.
And although some of them did disappear from the ranks and went through the town or something like that, and I know we had a couple of them that were Italian descent disappeared when they went through Rome. And I don't know if they ever did find them, but anyway, any of these people, I usually had to put them down the missing in action, but these people were on court-martials, were people who were picked up later someplace else. Back in the rear area someplace that picked them up and actually were deserters.
Right.
And of course, and with me being the first sergeant, I was the only one that I took care of the books and stuff to show things, and I was responsible then to appear before the court and as a witness against them to prove that they were absent.
Right.
And so I'd say that the whole group, as a group there, they average about 20 years of hard labor.
Oh, wow.
And the one guy we had, I know that had been in all kinds of trouble otherwise, AWOL and whatnot, was in the States here even. And he was kind of a guardhouse lawyer, and every time the officers would, and I would say something, but then he would speak up like he was a lawyer and knew what was right, and there was hearsay evidence and all this and that and the other thing. Every time he got up, I could just see him, and the judges tacking on a couple more years. Well, and he got through talking like he got 30 years. I never heard from any of them or about them afterwards, whether they had served the full time or whether they got out after the war was over or what.
Yeah. What was their defense?
Well, they didn't have any defense, it's just that they were scared and they took off.
No, they were just scared and took off.
Deserted.
Right. And so how did the rest of the unit feel about these guys that just took off?
Well, a lot of them, of course, didn't know about it so much, anything. But I'm sure that most of them felt that their lives were in jeopardy by these guys leaving.
Right. Let me see. There's one more question here. What was the food like?
The food?
Yeah, how was the food over there?
Well, it was mostly dry rations that you carried with you, except when you get off the line, maybe you've been up on the line a couple of weeks or something like that, and then you get to go back in the rest area for a few days and then move back up again. So it was mostly dry rations that you carried with you, which you got used to it, I guess.
Right.
And when we get back in the rest area, that was when the cooks would be there to cook a hot meal for you. One of the hot meals we missed was a Christmas meal. We were back in the rest area, and the cooks were cooking up a nice big turkey dinner for us. And early in the forenoon, and I don't know what time it was, 11 o'clock or so, the word came down that the Germans had busted through the line over on the east end, over by the pizza area. And they needed some help, and so load up and took off the whole works. So we didn't get to, didn't get our hot meal that day, and we got over where the other division was that was needed help. And I suppose you got to be careful how you say this. It was a counter division, and a couple of German patrols, I guess, had been out there and shot some shots up and stuff, and then all of them wanted to, because we got over there and set off some patrols, and there was nothing there. But otherwise, whenever we had hot meals, it was okay.
It was okay, not great, though.
Yeah.
did you do anything special for luck before you went into combat, or thought you'd do anything? I mean, did you have any, like, superstitions or anything?
Doing it for what?
For luck, just for good luck.
Oh. No, I don't recall that. I know a couple of days before we first went in, the first battle, chaplain came around to our area and made some appointments and served communion service to anybody that wanted it. And here it was held right up there on the static line, of course, but it was kind of a recessed road down below there, terraced, and they set up down there, so you go down there, you could have a communion service before you went into battle. And I guess all of them didn't, but I know I did.
Right.
Yeah.
What did you guys do for entertainment when you were, you were in the field, but you weren't on the front line? Did you?
Well, we had the USO shows. We get like going to Rome or some of these other towns, like say in the rest areas. And it was very interesting. I saw one show, the Andrews Sisters.
Oh.
They put on a show there one time for about an hour, and they just sang their hearts out. And the whole show, that's all there was, and there was the Andrews Sisters. Whereas you go to some of these shows, there were supposed to be somebody important on there that's put on the show. They'd do a few numbers, and then they'd have somebody else you'd never heard of put on some numbers. But that was one, and then there was one other one I remember that was the Hoosier Hot Shots. You never heard of them?
No, I haven't.
Well, that was in the early days of radio. There's I forget what station was that they were on. But it was just a kind of a jazz band deal. They played a washboard and a wash tub for drum and clarinets and banjo, I guess. But Hoosier Hot Shots, yeah. They were really good and interesting. I saw those. And Gary Moore, he put on a show once out in the desert when we were in training, and Jimmy Durante was there for that, and the rest of these camps, you could they usually had some music of some kind in there, and dancing. Sometimes they had girls you could dance with, sometimes you had to dance with another boy soldier. But and movies, of course, and some.
Did they make you did watching those movies like make you homesick?
Pardon?
Did watching those movies make you homesick?
Oh no, I don't think so. Then me anyway, yeah.
Did you guys do anything when you were, like, in the evenings, if you were out in the field? I mean, not just, like, going into town and recreating, but what did you guys do in the evenings just to pass the time?
Well, I didn't get too involved with the men, being I had to be at my post.
Oh, sure.
But I know I was one time there was a group, one group I know that were sort of kind of religious tint to them, which was fine. But every once in a while I'd hear this phonograph. I don't know where they found the phonograph, but somebody had a record there of the Great Speckled Bird. And they used to play that, and finally I told the guys, I wonder where they're always playing that song for. I said, I never heard it before, you know. Well, it's a religious song.